the number one hit music station. More music, more variety. Welcome to The Alternative. Playing today's new country. Oh, sorry, I was just practicing. I'm Matt from Matt Fogarty Voiceovers. I know you want to listen to your podcast, so I'm going to keep this super brief. If you're a program director and you're looking for a fresh sound on your station, hit me up. I'll do a free, no-obligation sample for you, and you can get a really good sense for how I'll sound on your station. Get in touch at mattfogartyvo.com. I'm seriously sitting by my computer hitting refresh right now. Email me. Do it.
Have you heard one of these? Have you heard one of these before, by the way?
I have. Yeah.
Do you like
them? Very good at it.
Well, thank you. I kind of love doing them.
Well, you've always been very good at getting things out of people. Very good interviewer.
Well, I did a lot of them, and I'd like to thank Paul Jessup and everybody else in the music industry for making me do those interviews.
This is the podcast for broadcast. Sound Off Podcast with Matt Kendall.
This week, I speak with Bob Harris, who has worked at some legendary radio stations across Canada. The Wolf in Peterborough, Ontario, which he actually launched. CJ92 in Calgary. Mix99 in Toronto. Show Mix96 and CJAD in Montreal. 97.7 Hits FM. TSN in Hamilton. And I left out a few, but you get the picture. Bob and I worked a lot together up until 2006, and we always stayed in touch. If you follow Bob on Facebook, you know he's had a battle with cancer. And we're going to talk about that towards the end of the show. We're also going to talk about his accomplishments, mistakes, and a lot of the serious fun he had along the way. I reached out to Bob in his home in St. Catharines, Ontario.
Bob, where is Bancroft, Ontario?
If you draw a straight line between Toronto and Ottawa, it's very close to the middle.
And this is where you grew up, correct?
My parents moved from Burlington to a little place called Potash Lake, which is about 15 minutes from Bancroft. So I grew up on Potash Lake, across from the Anchorage, away from 20 feet of water all my life.
What'd you grow up listening to in terms of radio?
I was fortunate enough that I spent some time in Toronto, and I got addicted to 680 CFTR. When I was living in Bancroft, you really couldn't get very much other than, you know, at night. You would hear WLS out of Chicago. I could get CJBQ out of Belleville, but it was predominantly CFTR that really kind of piqued my ears in terms of radio.
Was there any success in getting 1050 Chum in the area?
No, I got hooked onto CFTR and, you know, the personalities, Tom Brady and Coop, a little later on Steve Gregory at night. So, you know, they were my go-to whenever I got close to Toronto. And I was lucky enough that my dad at the time was working in Toronto. So there would be many times where I'd take trips to Toronto with him.
Did you make a beeline to Loyalist right after high school?
No, I didn't. I actually worked for very good friends of mine's parents who I got to know living on the lake. They were cottagers, and they actually became my second family, the Pearsons. Their mother more or less ran a company that was responsible for building delineators, you know, the stand-up flashing light signs and the, you know, black and orange cones. So I spent a lot of time doing that for two summers. And then I went to work for my older brother. He was in a company called TransCanada, and they built stainless steel wine and beer vats close to Toronto Airport. And I spent about a year and a half doing that. All in the while, my love for radio was growing. And I was lucky enough that while I spent some time in Bancroft, I got the opportunity to do some volunteer hours at a radio station that was joined with CJBQ. And, Bancroft, 1240 CJNH, was where I actually got my first touch of radio, my introduction to it. A friend of mine from high school and I, we actually hosted what you would call Kijiji Radio. People would call in on the weekends and tell us what they had for sale, give their phone numbers and the price, and then we'd move on to the next caller. I then was asked to do a top 40 show on a Sunday afternoon, and that's really where I got bit by the bug. I sent out air checks to CFTR, to Q107, you know, thinking that right away I was going to get a job because, hey, I was on the radio and I was great. I was lucky enough that I managed to strike up a little bit of a letter relationship with Steve Gregory. He told me to go to college. So I did. And that's when I went to Loyalist.
Is your first job after Loyalist in Peterborough?
Yes. My first job was Peterborough. Gord Gibb, the program director at that point, he was the guy that kind of started my radio career. And I thank him for it every time I see him. I was doing overnights for $3.15 an hour. That was my starting wage. And I would drive from Bancroft to Peterborough Friday night and Saturday night. I was fortunate enough that I kind of worked my way up over the course of the next few years to doing afternoons on the weekends. And then I was doing afternoons. And then I was fortunate enough to be able to move to morning show. And I took on the music responsibilities at that time. And then a few years later, I was asked to take over the radio station as program director.
I was really hoping we wouldn't, you know, take the opportunity to date you throughout this podcast, but so far we've already got a $3.15 an hour minimum wage. You've also been the host of shows like Swap Shop and Tradio.
Yes.
Which one was it that you hosted?
It was Swap Shop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was usually one of the two, and it was a fairly easy gig, as I remember, because they would announce the item, and then you just re-announce the item, and then give the phone number, and then move on to the next call.
Yeah, and it was amazing what people would sell in a small town like Bancroft. They would sell everything. They would sell tractor parts. They would sell clothing. They would sell old guitars, drums. It didn't matter, you know, what they had for sale. They would sell it.
I was one of the last to be involved with that era of radio, and somebody called me up and said they wanted to sell a wedding dress, a wedding cake, a whole bunch of wedding everything. And I just had to ask, what happened? When did he leave you? Did he leave you at the altar? Was it like a few days before?
I got in trouble once for laughing at something that somebody was selling. My buddy of mine and I, Chuck Bartlett, he's the guy that kind of got me into it. We just started laughing over nothing, and we got into the giggles, and it felt like eternity that we laughed.
How did you become interested in programming?
Yeah, I was offered the opportunity to put a rock station into Peterborough. It was really a interesting time because I'd never done that before. I'd been programming, you know, Chex, which was an AM Top 40 station in Peterborough for a couple of years, and then we did some research because the AC radio station in Peterborough just wasn't performing, and research showed that, you know, a rock station was what we should do. I, along with, you know, a number of people, Jeff Brown, who's now doing Jack in Vancouver, Mike Cooper, who I was fortunate enough to be working alongside. He spent some time doing mornings at Chex Radio after he left CFTR before he went back to Toronto. And we all just kind of sat around and talked about, you know, what would we expect from a radio station? What do we think a great rock station would sound like? And that's how The Wolf was born. It was through, you know, a lot of great conversations, music choices from a lot of people. And the logo and the name, I'm extremely proud of that it still is as it was when we launched it. And there's even some people who were, you know, on the radio station at that point that are still there, that made a great career out of working and living in Peterborough. That's a career highlight for me, building that radio station and launching it on Valentine's Day back in 1993.
So you had early success launching a radio station, which becomes a little bit infectious because once you do it once, then you do it again. But then you got picked up and you went to Calgary to work at CJ92. That was the next move, correct?
That was. They in Peterborough, they were actually experimenting with automation at that point. They came to me at one point as a, you know, a young, naive program director, and they talked about automating, you know, on the weekends and on the evenings. But in order to do that, we're going to have to eliminate this person and this person. I can remember that conversation, and I remember being very young and naive and standing up in the meeting and going, no, you're not. You're not going to fire all my friends. And then 2 months later, they let me go.
How long was your hair at that point? And do you think it made a difference?
I have pictures of that. I show my daughter. My daughter's 13 now, and I show her those pictures, and it was below my shoulder.
Both you and I flunked the mullet challenge back then.
Yeah, we all did.
By the way, extra marks for Bob Harris for having a Labatt Blue in hand for most of those pictures.
Yes, I was a student of my dad. My dad always had a beer in his hand, so I had some of those as well.
But that's a pretty nice jump. You get let go from Peterborough, and then you get to make the jump to Calgary.
It wasn't planned jump to Calgary, but I had reached out to JJ about interning with him in Vancouver while I was working in Peterborough, because I just wanted to grow. I wanted to learn more. And when I started having a conversation with JJ about flying out there and just watching him for a week, you know, at that point he said, hold on a second, you know, there may be something happening and I'll get in touch with you. And then the next thing I knew, he was at Standard Radio in Toronto. And during that time when he moved, I was let go. We had set up a meeting. I went to see him. We had a great conversation about radio and The Wolf. He thought that it was a pretty good sounding radio station. And, you know, he lived in Picton, Ontario, he's from Picton, Ontario. So he could actually hear the radio station down there. And subsequently, that led to a conversation with Gary Slate, a very quick conversation, as most conversations are with Gary. And JJ was kind enough to hook me up with a breakfast and a dinner with Gary Russell. I had dinner with Gary Russell, and Gary and I just had a phenomenal conversation about life and about radio. And I was just going there for interview experience. Gary at that time was running Calgary. And early off in the conversation, he said, you know, I'll be honest with you, I'm looking for a programmer who's got, you know, experience fighting in a competitive market. And I didn't have that because, you know, Peterborough was a small town at that time. And through the hour and a half conversation we had, I felt really comfortable with him. And at the end of the meeting, he said, you know, do you have any more questions? And I said, yeah, when do I start? And I have no idea where that question came from, because I'd never said it before in my life, and I haven't said it since. And Gary said, I'm going to talk to Gary Slate tomorrow about flying out and doing a monitor of CJ, and we'll take it from there. Okay, what's a monitor? I had no idea what a monitor was at that point. I'd never done one, never heard that, you know, that phrase before. 2 weeks later, I was in Calgary. I learned how to do a monitor, and I did a couple of days of listening, and I sat down with Gary in his office that morning. I remember that like it was yesterday, and we went through the monitor, and I mentioned some things to him, and I went home. And in December, he called me back. It was over the Christmas holidays. I remember because I was outside on the lake shoveling off a rink, and my little brother called and said, there's a guy from Calgary on the phone, and he offered me the job. I was ecstatic, and I was, you know, scared and nervous and excited all at the same point. I'd never been out west. I think at that time I'd only flown maybe 3 times in my life.
So you get to Calgary, and there's 2 questions really that I have about Calgary. And I know that seems crazy because you spend 8 years there.
Yeah.
What were the early challenges at CJ92?
Me learning how to program, like to really program, I think was the first challenge. I walked in there with, you know, I think too much ego, not enough knowledge. And I think, you know, what Gary Russell saw in me, and I thanked him for it much years later, was the ability for him to see through the lines in terms of what instincts I had. Him and I would spend every day in his office, and he had like a little chair that rocked. His office chair rocked back and forth, and he would put his, you know, hands together, fingertips touching. And we would just have conversations about radio, and we would have conversations about people, and we would have conversations about, you know, formatics. And eventually I started to change in terms of my, you know, my approach to dealing with people. I came in like a little bit of a bear in a china shop, and that was clearly the wrong thing to do. But, you know, shortly over time with his help, I started to get better at the gig. I started to really listen to other people's opinions and to get everybody's help. And I started to ask many more questions. And, you know, JJ's guidance at that point as well, you know, he was the VP of programming. And it wasn't very long before I really kind of figured out what I was doing. I remember almost that light switch just going on for me and going, all right, I kind of get it now. It's all about the people. It's not necessarily all about me. It's all about the people. That was a big learning curve for me, only because I'd never, and I think that was part of the thing that Gary was looking for, was that competitive sense, right? Somebody who can come in and be competitive and be strategic. I'd never had to do that. Never had to do that before. It was fun. Like, it wasn't a, Gary Russell, God rest his soul, was a brilliant general manager, and he was a brilliant person. He took on a lot of dad characteristics for me while I was working with him.
The other question about Calgary is, what was it like working with Jerry Forbes? Because you were just talking about the people aspect of the whole thing, and there's a very big personality to manage.
Yeah, Jerry, I didn't know who Jerry was. And I can remember Gary Russell saying, we're going to go for lunch and we're going to meet Jerry Forbes. I'd known who Marty was, or I knew who Marty Forbes was, GMing at Edmonton at the time. And, you know, and Gary Russell had told me that, you know, Jerry was his brother. You know, we went for lunch and Jerry was just a ball of fire. Oh, my God. He was a nonstop idea man. He was talking about things that we could do from, you know, a radio station perspective, things that he wanted to do in the community. He had musical suggestions of what the radio station should be. And in the back of my mind, I'm going, oh, my God, this guy is going to be like a one. He's going to be, he might be a little difficult to control, but boy, is his attitude and his way of doing things infectious. And I kind of liked that idea, because one of the things that I learned from Gary was, hey, you know, if you start doing things right, then other people will start doing things right. And before you know it, it's just like a snowball and everybody just kind of gets it. It just kind of takes on a life of its own. So bringing Jerry in was the start of something beautiful for CJ. Him and I butted heads, I think, right out of the gate. And I think that was still a little bit of my learning curve in terms of how to coach and relate to a morning guy. And then I read Howard Stern's book, Private Parts. And that kind of changed a lot for me in terms of relating to talent in general. I just started to help, and I started to listen to them more. And before you know it, like, magic things started to happen. You know, by that time, Gary Russell had left. Pat Holiday had come in. Gary left to go and take over our stations in Vancouver, and Pat Holiday came in. And Pat was a completely different general manager and a completely different person than Gary Russell. And the things that I learned from Pat were all personality driven and were all about working with and dealing with people. I think at that point, you know, my learnings from Gary Russell and definitely what I learned from Pat more or less finished the mold for me in terms of exactly how to do the job. And I got very good at relating with talent. I got very good at knowing how to identify promotions with salespeople that would not only give us great content and great contests on radio, but would also generate some revenue. Musically, we started to cherry pick songs that may have been a little too rock, on the rock side for CHR, but we felt we could play them on CJ, and we continued with that kind of strategy, and everybody just kind of fell in line. And God loved, you know, Gary Slate, he loved the idea of doing that, and Jerry Forbes even more than that. You know, Jerry just kind of bought into it. I remember him and I having conversations about music and, you know, becoming a bulldozer in the sense of, hey, you know, the middle of that bulldozer is rock. It's exactly what we do. You know, the fringe side, you know, on the left, maybe, you know, older stuff, you know, older fringe classic rock stuff. And then the right side of that bulldozer is going to be like top 40 rock that we can kind of pull in. And he led that charge with staff. He was just as much of a coach of talent and personality as I was there. He would take on the young guys and bring them in and talk them up and make sure that they understood what that station was all about and what those, you know, the station colors represented, and to be proud when you wore those station jackets. And we were fortunate enough that we just hit a stride. We kept that musical prowlness about us. And we had a music director at that time. His name was Ben Jeffrey. And Ben and I were just on the same keel. And you know what that's like when the music director gets on the same kind of keel as the program director, and you think exactly the same, and you just kind of understand what songs work, you know, and from a sonic perspective. And we were fortunate enough with not only that musical feel, but with that talent lineup that we had and the promotions that we did, you know, we ended up becoming the number one radio station in Calgary. And we took out a top 40 station that, you know, that at that point was playing Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears, and all of that stuff. Yeah, I remember that day. I remember Tom Peacock coming into. Tom Peacock was the general manager at that point. Pat had left to go to Toronto, and Tom Peacock came into a jock meeting and said, "We're number one." And we all kind of looked at each other and went, "Yeah, we know we're going to be number one. We're you know, at that point, really the only rock station in the city." And he says, "No, you're the number one station in the city." That was a marvelous moment. I have goosebumps telling you that. And I think that started a week-long party. We were just so happy and so excited that all that hard work and all those things that we had done in the community and all the people that we had brought into the radio station and coached up, it all kind of worked. We had a phenomenal sales team that I think were like little mini program directors and promotion directors, because we talked to everybody about what the sound of the radio station meant and who the audience was and what we were willing to do from a promotion perspective. We were doing things that, you know, from a promotion perspective that were crazy and large and just made that radio station what every radio station should be. You know, don't tune out. You're going to miss something. If you tune out, who knows what you're going to miss. I cherish that time. It was absolutely fantastic. Number two highlight of my career.
Okay, so the two things Bob did not mention were the incredible music clocks that CJ had. They were stellar. And they also had a 20 share.
It was 20.5.
I stand corrected. I think it's safe to say that'll never happen again in Calgary radio. In just a second, Bob moves to Toronto, finds love and a big challenge at the mix. And if you're wondering why the Michael Jackson song is playing in the background, it's because I know it's one of Bob's favorites. In fact, he thinks it's the best of all time. You see, Bob and I had a few lunches together and, well, we'd debate that sort of thing.
Imaging and production for radio made easy from Megatrax Production Music. Add a sense of British flair to your productions with London's No Sheet Music. From the team behind Wise Buddha, No Sheet Music are musicians and music fans. It's as simple as that. Their albums range from contemporary to classical, orchestral to electronic, and they're always usable and sonically excellent. Don't miss the hottest sounds by adding Deep East music to your deal. Music from Deep East elevates a story and amplifies a message with a serious buzz. Always fresh and intuitive, and of course, the highest quality, they've always got their ears to the ground for the latest worldwide trends. Head on over to Megatrax.com or call us at 818-255-7100 for your music licensing requests. That's Megatrax.com.
After CJ, is this when you go to Toronto? And how easy is it to transfer what you know from Calgary to Toronto into head office territory?
Toronto was a request for me to move. I had met a young lady who I had fallen in love with, and she was working in Toronto in the same business. And her name's Kim Rossi, and she was working at Mix at the time. And my mother at that point, her health was starting to decline. So I had actually called Gary and I'd said, "Look, if there's anything that you're, you have anything in Toronto, I'd be interested or anything in the area, because these are the situations." And about 3 weeks later, Gary called and asked me if I would take over the Mix. And, you know, I immediately jumped at the opportunity. And it wasn't because it was Toronto. It wasn't because it was the biggest market in the country. It was because I could be near family and I could continue that relationship with Kim, who was my girlfriend and now wife. It wasn't easy. I'm not going to tell you, you know, that it was. It wasn't easy. But I was educated again in a number of different ways. When you work in a building where its head office and the owner of the radio company is there, the dynamics change, you know, quite a bit. So I was hired and worked for Gary, and I also worked for Pat Holliday. Again, I was lucky enough to work for Pat twice. Pat was the GM of the Toronto stations. And Toronto was a hyper-competitive market. Most radio stations and radio companies, most radio companies generate most of the revenue out of Toronto for their companies. And, you know, so for the revenue challenge there and the revenue focus is very high. And, of course, that's driven by ratings and everything that comes with making a radio station great. You know, we had some ideas in terms of what we wanted to do with that brand, Mix 99, and what we needed to do. And we also had, you know, some ideas of, you know, holes that we could fill from a market perspective. You know, my experience was classic rock and new rock. That's what we had done in Calgary, and we'd done it with great success. And I left Calgary to go to Toronto on the heels of that success. So it was a challenge in a number of ways. It was a challenge because I had left Calgary with tremendous success, and I'd gone into a radio station that needed, you know, some help. And we were starting to do that. We were starting to lay plans to, you know, to lean it in a slightly different direction. And, you know, God love Gary, he wanted to continue with that mixed brand. He wanted to stay with, you know, where it was. We did some research, and you know, my expertise was not in that world. When it got to the point where, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be the right person for that job, knowing what he wanted to do with that station, you know, I raised my hand and I said to him, I said, you know, this with me here is not going to work because that's not my format. And I don't think I should be learning how to do that in this market where there is so much importance to revenue and everything. So I kind of fell on my sword there. And, you know, Gary is Gary's an incredibly loyal person. And he, a couple of days later, took me out for a drink across to a bar next door. And he said, how would you like to move to Montreal? And almost immediately I said, yes, I would do that for you. And he told me at that time that Neil Blair Bartram, who was running the Montreal operation, was going to come to Toronto and I was going to move to Montreal.
Congratulations, by the way, on getting a promotion to Montreal where you get to work with me.
There was a point in that conversation, I'm not going to lie to you, where, you know, I had a tremendous weight, you know, lifted off of my shoulders. And I had, you know, several colleagues from that Toronto operation call me and say, congratulations, you got out. But you were a delight. You know, you and I knew each other a little bit.
Yeah, we had the Alberta dynamic between the Bear and CJ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we would see each other, I don't know, maybe a couple of times a year in Alberta. You know, moving to Montreal was an unknown because I knew you. I didn't know anybody else. I casually knew the general manager, Rob Braid, at that time, but I didn't know anything about the market. I didn't know anything about, you know, the three stations that we had. I didn't know anything about, you know, whether or not I had to learn French or what. So it was probably the most exciting career move, yet unknown career move that I made.
Well, the minute you got to Montreal, you knew as much French as Blair Bartram.
You know, the funny thing is, I was very good at French in school. I didn't know why. And subsequently, I found out later in life that my biological father was actually from Richmond, Quebec. So I spent a couple of years in my much younger days, apparently, in Richmond. So it was back in there, in my brain, but I just never chose to dig it out. And that was my biggest regret leaving. When I left Montreal, that I didn't learn the language. My daughter has learned it, and my wife picked that up while she was there, but I did not.
How do you explain to people how radio in Quebec is different? So you were running three Anglophone stations, but how do you tell the rest of Canada how it's different? How do you explain it?
It is different, and it's different because of the nature of the city and the nature of the people. It's funny, when I went in there, I didn't think it was any different. I, you know, you know, even working in, you know, Calgary, Toronto, Peterborough, you know, there were a lot of similarities between those markets. But Montreal was very different. The people, first and foremost, there was a passion in Montrealers like I've never experienced before. I tell people that I never talk more about hockey, religion, and politics in my life, you know, in those, I think, almost 9 years that I lived in Montreal. The music is different there. They have a different appreciation for different sounds, and they have different appreciations for different bands, and they have a stronger appetite for taking chances. And it took me a little while to, and when I say a little while, probably about a year and a half. And you helped me a lot, along with our promotion director, Matthew Wood, you know, and Terry, with, you know, just kind of explaining to me what the difference between, you know, one, living there, two, radio there, and the music. I describe it, it's like Montreal is a major market, and then the Anglo radio stations are kind of a medium market inside that major market. But the Francophone listeners tune to the Anglo radio stations, the English radio stations. So the English radio stations, in some ways, are more popular than the Francophone stations, because the English radio stations have both English and French listeners. And within that, in those two, English and French, there are different personality traits, and there are different likes, and there are different dislikes. And you've got to try and find that line to walk. It's antiquated in terms of radio time, but hit non-hit is still alive in Montreal. And that allowed us to kind of find those lines in order to, you know, to walk. And on-air content was different. And it kind of amazed me that it was very personal. Even though it was kind of like a medium market in a large market, it was very much a small market in terms of how radio related to people in the community. You know, there were names that were mentioned of, you know, long established businesses, and certainly the hockey team, the Canadians, were kings of that city. They were very prominent. But it was very down to earth, very real, very positive, and not afraid to say what's on your mind about anything.
And you got to manage three radio stations with high powered talent on all of them. And I think for a lot of people who listen to this podcast, they would marvel at the idea that you were program director for Jerry Forbes, but also for Terry DeMonte, Ted Bird, and your wife, Kim Rossi. There was success on all these radio stations. How'd you manage all this talent?
Thank you for that. You know, I don't think there was always success on all of them. You know, in Montreal, there were some hiccups, and there was some challenge. You know, my years of working outside of that market, Montreal, and then coming to, you know, to there to see how talents prep and the talents prepare, you know, was much different than what I had seen in other markets. And, you know, one of my challenges there was to, you know, try and instill a prep routine and, you know, the traditional prep routine, which anybody who's been in radio, you know, normally thinks of as, okay, you prep the day before, and then you prep the early morning when you come in, and then, you know, you do the show. And I was trying to instill those kind of things. And one of the things that I learned, you know, especially there, was, you know, sometimes that just doesn't work for personalities. Sometimes, you know, they have their own way of doing it, and you have to trust them. And the ultimate showing of that is, what does the show sound like? You know, what are the numbers? I learned that probably a little too late in Montreal with Terry and Ted, because, you know, I think I was just trying to get them to move towards what I was thinking was, you know, the way to do it, when in reality they had done it for so many years the way they were doing it, and they had success. So I think we agreed at one point to meet kind of halfway in the middle. And as you say, it started to, you know, as I like to call it, we had serious fun. I've always had that phrase in the back of my head, and I don't know where it came from. You know, we were serious about doing it, but we always had fun doing it. During that time period, you know, Terry had an offer to move to Calgary, And I think it was a great experience for Terry to do that. And, you know, he got a taste of, you know, of another market, different level of competitiveness. He loved the West. And I'm happy he did that. You know, Terry and I are still friends. You know, I haven't seen him physically in a while, but, you know, we talk every once in a while on Facebook or Twitter, or, you know, we text each other once in a while. But I learned a lot from that man. He's probably one of the best communicators on air I think I've ever seen. He's certainly one of the best interviewers I've ever had the good fortune to work with. And passion, probably one of the most passionate person about his craft that I've ever seen. Dedicated, passionate, professional, and wants to win all the time.
Gary Slate sold Standard, it became Astral, and then eventually, you know, it morphed again into Bell. At some point, you find your way down the 401 and then a little bit further to the Niagara region in St. Catharines. So what precipitated that move, and how much fun was it being near Toronto again?
You know, Gary and I had started talking to me about 3 years into my time in Montreal about, you know, returning back to the Hamilton area to take on the GM responsibilities at that radio station. And it was just in its infancy when he sold the radio stations to Astral. I had talked to Rob Braid about, you know, taking that next step in my career and wanting to become a general manager. And, you know, there are many things I thank Rob for. And, you know, I think he was a champion for that next step for me. And Rob taught me not only, you know, those little intricacies of, you know, becoming a general manager. He taught me more about how to, you know, communicate with head office, you know, dodge the bullets, die in the mountains you want to, as opposed to, you know, not the mountains you want to. And when Astral bought Standard, everything was put on hold. And I was very fortunate, as I think most of the people in Montreal were when Astral bought us. We got to meet, you know, the key players in Astral and understand what that company was all about. They were a great company. They had passion for their talent, passion for, you know, having fun, passion for working hard. You know, we saw that firsthand in the Montreal operation. You know, I don't think they owned that radio company long enough, because I think it would have been a phenomenal radio company across Canada once their vision had moved across the country. But, you know, they sold to Bell before that could happen. When Astral got to know me well enough, they asked again if I would move to Hamilton and become general manager. I was lucky enough that when I was in Montreal, Luke Tremblay, who took over for Rob, was again very, very kind and very, you know, forthcoming in allowing me to take on some of those junior GM responsibilities. So I got a taste of that role when I was exiting Montreal. And when I went to work as a GM in Hamilton, I started to work immediately closer with Ian Lurie. Ian Lurie had kind of been in the background my entire career. He was a CFO and more or less the HR guy at Standard Radio. He took over the operation of Astral Radio under Astral. And I began to report directly to him as a GM. You know, Ian has played an integral part in my life since then and continues to. You know, as does Gary Slate. The GM responsibility in Hamilton, the first day, I can remember being in my office in Hamilton, having everybody come in and asking questions of me. Salespeople, traffic, continuity, and, you know, sales managers. And that was something that I knew was going to happen, but not on the first day. And it kind of, it was like, okay, you've got the keys, now you're running with it. And I loved it. I loved every single thing about it. I love that I got a chance to, you know, work with, you know, some great people. I got a chance to shape culture. I got a chance to coach and lead managers in terms of, you know, imparting, you know, the things that I had learned over the years from all of the GMs that I worked with: Gary Russell, Tom Peacock, Pat Holliday, Rob Braid. and begin to impart, you know, some programming knowledge on the people who were running, you know, the radio stations at that point as well. So I think the first, you know, 6 months was a straight up learning curve, because not only with all of those responsibilities, you've got to, you know, learn the P&L, and you got to, you know, dig into the business side of things. And I was more or less a product guy through and through. So the sales side and, you know, the revenue sort of things was now something that I was responsible for. So it was a matter of juggling, you know, time and trusting people to teach you those things, and a little bit like going back to school again. And then it was wonderful. I loved every single moment of that experience.
And you got to launch TSN Radio in Hamilton. And it's funny because we talked about, I mean, your career kind of starts with a launch, and then you're at the Mix in Toronto and you're like, you know, I'm not really adept to this format, but here you are, general manager, and here comes a sports format that you have to unveil.
Sports has always been, I've always been a sports fan. I am a diehard Montreal Canadiens fan. I am a Dallas Cowboy fanatic. I am a huge fan of OHL hockey, and that started when I was back in Peterborough with the Peets. TSN in Hamilton, it was the brainchild of Victor Giacomelli. He was our general sales manager at that time. And what a treasure Victor is. We were lucky enough to get him in Hamilton to oversee sales in both our St. Catharines division and the Hamilton division. So it was his brainchild. He came to me and said, you know what? I think there's a revenue opportunity if we were to approach head office and bring in a TSN. You know, he had worked for Corus previous to that, and Corus had the Hamilton Tiger Cats at, you know, their station in Hamilton. And like myself, Victor was a sports guy. We just loved the thought of having a sports station in that building. We were fortunate enough to speak to head office, propose some numbers, approach the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and subsequently the Hamilton Bulldogs and the OHL. We were fortunate enough to secure those rights. We put together a skeleton staff, which included the legendary and wonderful Jim Taddy. Man, if you want to talk sports, Jim Taddy is the guy. We found a gem of a broadcaster, young guy. Marshall Ferguson is his name, and Marshall, you know, being that former quarterback for McMaster, knew football in and out. He wanted to be an on-air talent. Looked at him, and we looked at Jim Taddy, you know, we were like, okay, we got some anchors here. Shortly after we struck the deal with the Tiger Cats, we proposed the idea of Marshall doing play-by-play, and he's still doing play-by-play. That was a great story, just seeing a guy, you know, who wanted to pursue a career, had played the sport, knew it intimately, pursued his dream from a radio perspective, and then, you know, within 2 years, he's doing play-by-play for a major CFL franchise. And with the help of Jim Taddy, helping us all, Jim did, with the operation of a sports station and the priorities for a sports station. It was fun. Like that, there's nothing more fun than operating a sports station. Nothing more fun.
In just a second, Bob faces his biggest challenge ever, battling cancer. And he shares what he's gone through over the last few years and where he is now. Bob, you've always been very good about sort of breaking down life and saying, okay, this is the moment where you need to fix this in your life in order to become a better person. I was always interested to know what was going through your mind and how you were going to cope when you got the news that you had cancer. What goes through your mind, and then how do you tackle it?
It was tough. It was scary. I was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic melanoma, which means that I had a mole. They think it was in the back of my head that had metastasized and found its way into my bloodstream. And then we found out that I had a tennis ball sized tumor in the top of my left lung. My daughter was 10 at that time. She's now about to turn 13. And that's all I thought about. When you hear stage four, you know, you immediately think, time's up. And all I kept thinking about was her. And I kept thinking about, I'm not going to be your dad anymore. And you have to have conversations with your wife that you don't want to have. And you have to think about, you know, the end. And that's not a very pleasurable thing to think about. Inherently, you just want to win that fight. You just want to do whatever you can to take that thing out of you that's trying to kill you. And we were ridiculously fortunate and so lucky that we found that. You know, there were many conversations with my wife and, you know, when we had to tell my daughter, you know, that I had, you know, my doctors initially discovered with, you know, a mass in my chest. And we asked my doctors at that point, you know, through tears, you know, I have a 10-year-old daughter. How do I tell her that? When do I tell her? And they said, you tell her right away. And I was a little stymied at that, but they said, you tell her right away because you don't want to walk home, you know, 2 weeks later and tell her you have cancer. You have to warm her up to that. And it was the worst conversation of my life. I never want to have that conversation again. I don't want to see that look in my child's eyes. No child should hear that. My daughter has, as most kids do when they get into those situations, they find strength somehow. And my daughter, when we told her that my doctors found a lump in daddy's chest, she jumped into my wife's arms. She started to cry. I started to cry. My wife started to cry. And she asked me a question that I wasn't prepared for. She said, are you going to die? And I didn't know how to answer that question. I wasn't prepared for that. And I said, no, honey, the doctors are going to do everything they can. And as I said that, I didn't even know if that was true. And then she asked me where it was, and I pointed to her, you know, the top left of my chest. And then she said, can I punch it out of your chest? And I said, sure. And she walked over and she, you know, gave me a little bit harder than a love tap exactly where that was. And throughout the entire treatment, that was what she did. She didn't talk about it very much, but she would just walk up and she would give me a little love tap. And through the course of that treatment, you know, the love taps got harder. that was tough. That was, I never want to deal with that type of conversation again, ever. We were fortunate enough that, you know, we found it and it had only metastasized to one part of my body. Normally when, you know, melanoma metastasizes, it goes to all the major organs in your body and sometimes into the brain. But I was lucky it just stayed in the top left of my chest. The doctors here where I'm living now in St. Catharines, you know, they thought about, you know, removing my left lung because it was only in one place. And my wife, you know, God love her, she was second opinion. And I had let know, you know, three of the people that have been, you know, the most important in my life and career, Pat Holliday, Ian Lurie, and Gary Slate, know that I was battling that. And every once in a while, every 3 or 4 days, Gary Slate would email and he would say, you know, how you feeling? Hope you're doing good. Can I help you? And over the course of the next 2 weeks, those emails came more frequent and the language became more towards, I want to help you. And then my wife and I decided to take him up on his help And he had just made substantial donations to multiple hospitals in Toronto. And we were fortunate enough to, with his help, to get an appointment with, you know, their chief oncologist for melanoma, Dr. David Hoag, at Princess Margaret the following week. Dr. Hoag told us in our first meeting that there was something called a clinical trial for the type of cancer I had that has been known to be effective on the type of tumor I had. It had a 70% response rate. And at some point, it had been known to completely remove the tumor. And it was something called immunotherapy. And so for the next 10 months, I did immunotherapy. And immunotherapy is taking drugs much like you would in a chemo situation. And I was in the chemo bay, or as they call it, chemo daycare at Princess Margaret, with everybody else who was battling that horrible disease. And for the first 3 months, I would go every 3 months and I would get 2 infusions. They would last about 7 hours in total. The 2 drugs are nivolumab and ipilimumab. And those happened every 3 weeks of the first of the 3 months. And you would get CAT scans every 3 months to see how you were doing. And my first CAT scan at the first, you know, 3 months of treatment showed that tennis ball sized tumor had shrunk to a marble. And that was hope for me. You know, through those first 5 months leading up to that moment, I didn't know, you know, whether or not I was going to live. And the next 3 months of treatment, the tumor was the size of a ballpoint pen. And then 3 months later, it was gone. No radiation, no chemo, no loss of hair. I worked for the first 5 months of treatment, and then my body just got tired. And I slept, you know, basically from, you know, midway through April, May, June, and half of July. I went back to work the following September. Half of the man I was, which I appreciated. Cancer put me back in shape, if you can say that. I lost a significant amount of weight, which I needed to do. And I learned a lot about myself during those months of treatment, the time off I had. It is the ultimate bullshit meter. And what I mean by that, it is it immediately teaches you what matters and what doesn't matter. And the things that you think matter don't matter. It puts everything in perspective. And you immediately become grateful for life. You become grateful for the people around you. Your attitude changes on everything. Life is just glorious and different from that moment on. And I thank the doctors and the nurses, the entire medical system, Gary Slate, my wife and my daughter. I'm fortunate enough to still be here.
It's an incredible story, and I only got to hear it through Facebook. It sounded very grim, especially after people told me. And then the recovery is an amazing recovery, and it goes back to second and third opinions. How awesome are those?
Yes.
And how wonderful is it? Because a lot of people don't go through this with other people. And yeah. For you to have the support system that you did of, you know, friends reaching out and calling. And I wanted to do a podcast with you, and the timing was right. I thought the time was right about now. It actually came to me in a dream the other day. Oh, my God. I've got to speak to Bob.
Yeah. I love telling that story, Matt, because I think it's important for people to know that there is help coming, and immunotherapy is it. You know, you can see advertisements on TV now for drugs that are associated with immunotherapy. you know, Keytruda you see advertised on radio or TV stations in the States. You know, that the type of treatment that I described is now the standard of care for melanoma cancer patients in the United States. One of those two drugs, nivolumab, is approved for care here in Canada under OHIP. The other one, ipilimumab, is not yet, I believe. And immunotherapy is turning the immune system back on to fight the type of cancer you have. How crazy does that sound? Turning your immune system back on to fight the type of cancer you have. That's what it is. So as soon as they unlock the pathways for all the other types of cancers that we have in the world, immunotherapy should be able to eradicate it.
I think your story has just given hope to so many people.
Yeah. And it was developed by a guy in Houston back in the 1970s. His name is James Allison. And I, when my time off, I researched him and I actually sent him a note. And I said, thank you for your life's work. And this is the situation I'm in. I'm not sure what's going to happen. I sent him this note early on in my treatment. And he sent me a note back. And he said, I wish you all well. I hope the treatment works for you. And when it did, I sent him another note and I said, it did work. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And one day I will shake your hand. And I'm going to Houston in a couple of months to shake his hand and say thank you.
Any chance the Cowboys are playing?
I'm going to try and make it that weekend.
Thought you
I'm
might.
I'm going to try and do that.
As you look to the future, and you're just looking, of course, to go and meet the doctor in Houston. Is there anything else you're looking ahead at in the future?
Right now, no. I'm Bell and I parted ways last May. I'm a year retired, or as my daughter would say, you just don't have a job. And I'm starting to think about what to do next just to keep my myself busy. I don't want to do media anymore. I mean, where I live, the opportunities don't present itself. But, you know, I had a great run. I had tremendous success. I had the ability to work with some of the greatest talent and greatest people in the country in that business, yourself included. I'm enjoying what I'm doing right now, which is really kind of nothing. I'm my daughter's Uber driver, but I don't make any money doing that. So I will find something part-time-ish to do, and I'll be happy because that's what's important, and that's what I've ultimately learned through everything.
I will survive. I will survive. Yeah, yeah.
Just a quick update. Bob is going to be 2 years cancer-free on August 23rd. You can reach out to him. All the information to contact Bob is in the show notes of this episode. Thanks for listening to the end.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer. And we are the hosts of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com and listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all had.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.